Rincewind reached under the desk and grabbed the librarian, who was still hunched under his blanket.
"Come on," I said.
"Ooh."
"I'll buy you a drink," said Rincewind desperately.
The librarian unfolded like a four-legged spider.
"Ooh?"
Rincewind half-dragged the ape from his nest and out through the door. He didn't head for the main gates, but for an otherwise undistinguished area of wall, where a few loose stones had for 2,000 years offered students an unobtrusive way in after lights out. Then he stopped so suddenly that the librarian cannoned into him, and the luggage ran into both of them.
"Ooh!"
"Oh, gods," he said. "Look at that!"
"Huh?"
There was a shiny black tide flowing out of a grating near the kitchens. Early evening starlight glinted off millions of little black backs. But it wasn't the sight of the cockroaches that was so upsetting. It was the fact that they were marching in step, 100 abreast. Of course, like all the informal inhabitants of the university, the roaches were a little unusual, but there was something particularly unpleasant about the sound of billions of very small feet hitting the stones in perfect time. Rincewind stepped gingerly over the marching column. The librarian jumped it. The luggage, of course, followed them, with a noise like someone tap-dancing over a bag of crisps. And so, forcing the luggage to go all the way around to the gates anyway, because otherwise it'd only batter a hole in the wall, Rincewind quit the university with all the other insects and small frightened rodents, and decided that if a few quiet beers wouldn't allow him to see things in a different light, then a few more probably would. It was certainly worth a try. That was why he wasn't present in the Great Hall for dinner. It would turn out to be the most important missed meal of his life. Further along the university wall, there was a faint clink, as a grapnel caught the spikes that lined its top. A moment later, a slim, black-clad figure dropped lightly into the university grounds and ran soundlessly towards the Great Hall, where it was soon lost in the shadows. No one would have noticed it anyway. On the other side of the campus, the sorcerer was walking towards the gates of the university. Where his feet touched the cobbles, blue sparks crackled and evaporated the early evening dew. It was very hot. The big fireplace at the turnwise end of the Great Hall was practically incandescent. Wizards feel the cold easily, so the sheer blast of heat from the roaring logs was melting candles 20 feet away and bubbling the varnish on the long tables. The air over the feast was blue with tobacco smoke, which writhed into curious shapes as it was bent by random drifts of magic. On the centre table, the complete carcass of a whole roast pig looked extremely annoyed at the fact that someone had killed it without waiting for it to finish its apple. And the model university made of butter was sinking gently into a pool of grease. There was a lot of beer about. Here and there, red-faced wizards were happily singing ancient drinking songs, which involved a lot of knee-slapping and cries of, "Ho!" The only possible excuse for this sort of thing is that wizards are celibate and have to find their amusement where they can. Another reason for the general conviviality was the fact that no one was trying to kill anyone else. This is an unusual state of affairs in magical circles. The higher levels of wizardry are a perilous place. Every wizard is trying to dislodge the wizards above him while stamping on the fingers of those below. To say that wizards are healthily competitive by nature is like saying that piranhas are naturally a little peckish. However, since the Great Mage Wars left whole areas of the disc uninhabitable, at least by anyone who wanted to wake up the same shape or even the same species as they went to bed. Wizards have been forbidden to settle their differences by magical means because it caused a lot of trouble for the population at large, and in any case it was often difficult to tell which of the resultant patches of smoking fat had been the winner. So they traditionally resort to knives, subtle poisons, scorpions in shoes, and hilarious booby traps involving razor-sharp pendulums. On Small God's Eve, however, it was considered extremely bad form to kill a brother wizard, and wizards felt able to let their hair down without fear of being strangled with it. The Arch-Chancellor's chair was empty. Wheezy Goose was dining alone in his study, as befits a man chosen by the gods after their serious discussion with sensible senior wizards earlier in the day. Despite his 80 years, he was feeling a little bit nervous and hardly touched his second chicken. In a few minutes he would have to make a speech. Wheezy Goose had in his younger days sought power in strange places. He'd wrestled with demons in blazing octagrams, stared into dimensions that men were not meant to wot of, and even outfaced the unseen University Grants Committee. But nothing in the 8 circles of nothingness was quite so bad as a couple of 100 expectant faces staring up at him through the cigar smoke. The heralds would soon be coming by to collect him. He sighed and pushed his pudding away untasted, crossed the room, stood in front of the big mirror, and fumbled in the pocket of the robe for his notes. After a while, he managed to get them in some sort of order and cleared his throat.
"My brothers in art," he began. "I cannot tell you how much I find traditions of this ancient university, as I look around me and see the pictures of arch-chancellors gone before."
He paused, sorted through his notes again, and plunged on rather more certainly.
"Standing here tonight, I am reminded of the story about the three-legged peddler and the merchant's daughters. It seems that this merchant—"
There was a knock at the door.
"Enter,"
Wazy Goose barked, and peered at the notes carefully.
"This merchant," he muttered, this merchant had three daughters, I think it was. Yes, it was three. It would appear—"
He looked into the mirror and turned round. He started to say, "Who are you?" and found that there are things worse than making speeches, after all. The small dark figure creeping along the deserted corridors heard the noise and didn't take too much notice. Unpleasant noises were not uncommon in areas where magic was commonly practiced. The figure was looking for something. It wasn't sure what it was, only that it would know it when it found it. After some minutes, its search led it to Wazy Goose's room. The air was full of greasy coils. Little particles of soot drifted gently on the air currents, and there were several foot-shaped burn marks on the floor. The figure shrugged. There was no accounting for the sort of things you found in wizards' rooms. It caught sight of its multifaceted reflection in the shattered mirror, adjusted the set of its hood, and got on with the search. Moving like one listening to inner direction, it padded noiselessly across the room until it reached the table whereon stood a tall, round, and battered leather box. It crept closer and gently raised the lid. The voice from inside sounded as though it was talking through several layers of carpet when it said,
"At last! What kept you?"
"I mean, how did they all get started? I mean, back in the old times, there were real wizards. There was none of this levels business. They just went out and did it. Pow!"
One or two of the other customers in the darkened bar of the Mended Drum Tavern looked around hastily at the noise. They were new in town. Regular customers never took any notice of surprising noises like groans or unpleasantly gristly sounds. It was a lot healthier. In some parts of the city, curiosity didn't just kill the cat. It threw it in a river with lead weights tied to its feet. Rincewind's hands weaved unsteadily over the array of empty glasses on the table in front of him. He had almost been able to forget about the cockroaches. After another drink, he might manage to forget about the mattress, too.
"Whee! A fireball! Fizz! Vanishing like smoke! Whee! Sorry."
The librarian carefully pulled what remained of his beer out of the reach of Rincewind's flailing arms.
"Proper magic!"
Rincewind stifled a belch.
"Ook!"
Rincewind stared into the frothy remnants of his last beer, and then, with extreme care, in case the top of his head fell off, leaned down and poured some into a saucer for the luggage. It was lurking under the table, which was a relief. It usually embarrassed him in bars by sidling up to drinkers and terrorising them into feeding it crisps. He wondered fuzzily where his train of thought had been derailed.
"Where was I?"
"Ook,"
the librarian hinted.
Yeah, Rincewind brightened. "They didn't have all this levels and grades business, you know. They had sorcerers in those days. They went out in the world and found new spells and had adventures."
He dipped a finger in a puddle of beer and doodled a design on the stained, scratched timber of the table. One of Rincewind's tutors had said of him that to call his understanding of magical theory abysmal is to leave no suitable word to describe his grasp of its practice. This had always puzzled him. He objected to the fact that you had to be good at magic to be a wizard. He knew he was a wizard, deep in his head. Being good at magic didn't have anything to do with it. That was just an extra. It didn't actually define somebody.
"When I was a little boy," he said wistfully, "I saw this picture of a sorcerer in a book. He was standing on a mountain top, waving his arms, and the waves were coming right up, you know, like they do down in Ark Bay in a gale, and there were flashes of lightning all around him."
"Ook,"
said the librarian.
I don't know why they didn't. Perhaps he had rubber boots on. Rincewind snapped and went on dreamily. And he had this staff and a hat on, just like mine, and his eyes were sort of glowing, and there was all this sort of, like, glitter coming out of his fingertips, and I thought, one day I'll do that. And,
ooh,
just a half, then.
Ooh.
How do you pay for this stuff? Every time anyone gives you any money, you eat it.
Ooh.
Amazing. Rincewind completed his sketch in the beer. There was a stick figure on a cliff. It didn't look much like him. Drawing in stale beer is not a precise art, but it was meant to. That's what I wanted to be, he said. Pow! Not all this messing around, all this books and stuff. That isn't what it should be all about. What we need is real wizardry. The last remark would have earned the prize for the day's most erroneous statement if Rincewind hadn't then said, "It's a pity there aren't any of them around any more." Spelter rapped on the table with his spoon. He was an impressive figure in his ceremonial robe with the purple and vermin hood of the Venerable Council of Seers and the yellow sash of a fifth-level wizard. The vermin is a small black-and-white relative of the lemming found in the cold Hublandish regions. Its skin is rare and highly valued, especially by the vermin itself. A selfish little bastard will do anything rather than let go of it. He'd been fifth level for 3 years, waiting for one of the 64 sixth-level wizards to create a vacancy by dropping dead. He was in an amiable mood, however. Not only had he just finished a good dinner, he had also had in his quarters a small phial of a guaranteed untastable poison, which, used correctly, should guarantee him promotion within a few months. Life looked good. The big clock at the end of the hall trembled on the verge of 9 o'clock. The tattoo with the spoon hadn't had much effect. Spelter picked up a pewter tankard and brought it down hard. "Brothers," he shouted, and nodded as the hubbub died away. "Thank you. Be upstanding, please, for the ceremony of the, keys." There was a ripple of laughter and a general buzz of expectancy as the wizards pushed back their benches and got unsteadily to their feet. The double doors to the hall were locked and triple barred. An incoming arch-chancellor had to request entry 3 times before they would be unlocked, signifying that he was appointed with the consent of wizardry in general, or some such thing. The origins were lost in the depths of time, which was as good a reason as any for retaining the custom. The conversation died away. The assembled wizardry stared at the doors. There was a soft knocking. "Go away!" shouted the wizards, some of them collapsing at the sheer subtlety of the humour. Spelter picked up the great iron ring that contained the keys to the university. They weren't all metal, they weren't all visible. Some of them looked very strange indeed. "Who is that who knocketh without?"
"I do."
What was strange about the voice was this. It seemed to every wizard that the speaker was standing right behind him. Most of them found themselves looking over their shoulders. In that moment of shocked silence, there was the sharp little snick of the lock. They watched in fascinated horror as the iron bolts travelled back of their own accord, the great oak bulks of timber, turned by time into something tougher than rock, slid out of their sockets. The hinges flared from red through yellow to white, and then exploded. Slowly, with a terrible inevitability, the doors fell into the hall. There was an indistinct figure standing in the smoke from the burning hinges.
"Bloody hell, Virid," said one of the wizards nearby. "That was a good one."
As the figure strode into the light, they could all see that it was not, after all, Virid Wazygoose. He was at least a head shorter than any other wizard, and wore a simple white robe. He was also several decades younger. He looked about 10 years old, and in one hand he held a staff considerably taller than he was.
"Here, he's no wizard. Where's his hood, then? Where's his hat?"
The stranger walked up the line of astonished wizards until he was standing in front of the top table. Spelter looked down at the thin young face framed by a mass of blonde hair, and most of all he looked into the 2 golden eyes that glowed from within. But he felt they weren't looking at him. They seemed to be looking at a point 6 inches beyond the back of his head. Spelter got the impression that he was in the way, and considerably surplus to immediate requirements. He rallied his dignity and pulled himself up to his full height.
"What is the meaning of this?" he said. It was pretty weak, he had to admit, but the steadiness of that incandescent glare appeared to be stripping all the words out of his memory.
"I have come," said the stranger.
"Come? Come for what?"
"To take my place. Where is the seat for me?"
"Are you a student?" demanded Spelter, white with anger. "What is your name, young man?"
The boy ignored him and looked around at the assembled wizards.
"Who is the most powerful wizard here?" he said. "I wish to meet him."
Spelter nodded his head. Two of the college porters who had been sidling towards the newcomer for the last few minutes appeared at either elbow.
"Take him out and throw him in the street," said Spelter.
The porters, big, solid, serious men, nodded. They gripped the boy's pipe-stem arms with hands like banana bunches.
"Your father will hear of this," said Spelter severely.
"He already has,"
said the boy. He glanced up at the two men and shrugged.
"What's going on here?"
Spelter turned to see Skarma Bilias, head of the Order of the Silver Star. Whereas Spelter tended towards the wiry, Bilias was expansive, looking rather like a small captive balloon that had been for some reason draped in blue velvet and vermin. Between them, the wizards averaged out as two normal-sized men. Unfortunately, Bilias was the type of person who prided himself on being good with children. He bent down as far as his dinner would allow and thrust a whiskery red face towards the boy.
"What's the matter, lad?"
he said.
"This child has forced his way into here because he says he wants to meet a powerful wizard," said Spelter disapprovingly. Spelter disliked children intensely, which was perhaps why they found him so fascinating. At the moment he was successfully preventing himself from wondering about the door.
"Nothing wrong with that," said Bilias. "Any lad worth his salt wants to be a wizard. I wanted to be a wizard when I was a lad. Isn't that right, lad?"
"Are you puissant?"
said the boy.
"Hm?"
"I said, are you puissant? How powerful are you?"
"Powerful,"
said Bilias. He stood up, fingered his eighth-level sash, and winked at Spelter.
"Oh, pretty powerful. Quite powerful, as wizards go."
"Good. I challenge you. Show me your strongest magic, and when I have beaten you, why, then I shall be Arch-Chancellor."
"Why, you impudent—"
began Spelter, but his protest was lost in the roar of laughter from the rest of the wizards. Bilias slapped his knees, or as near to them as he could reach.
"A duel, eh?" he said. "Pretty good, eh?"
"Dueling is forbidden, as well you know," said Spelter. "Anyway, it's totally ridiculous. I don't know who did the doors for him, but I will not stand here and see you waste all our time."
"Now, now," said Bilias, "what's your name, lad?"
"Coin."
"Coin, sir?" snapped Spelter.
"Well now, Coin," said Bilias, "you want to see the best I can do, eh?"
"Yes."
"Yes, sir!" snapped Spelter.
Coin gave him an unblinking stare, a stare as old as time, the kind of stare that basks on rocks on volcanic islands and never gets tired. Spelter felt his mouth go dry. Bilias held out his hands for silence. Then, with a theatrical flourish, he rolled up the sleeve of his left arm and extended his hand. The assembled wizards watched with interest. Eighth levels were above magic, as a rule, spending most of their time in contemplation, normally of the next menu, and, of course, avoiding the attentions of ambitious wizards of the seventh level. This should be worth seeing. Bilias grinned at the boy, who returned it with a stare that focused on a point a few inches beyond the back of the old wizard's head. Somewhat disconcerted, Bilias flexed his fingers. Suddenly this wasn't quite the game he had intended, and he felt an overpowering urge to impress. It was swiftly overtaken by a surge of annoyance at his own stupidity in being unnerved.
"I shall show you," he said, and took a deep breath, "Maligree's wonderful garden."
There was a susurration from the diners. Only four wizards in the entire history of the university had ever succeeded in achieving the complete garden. Most wizards could create the trees and flowers, and a few had managed the birds. It wasn't the most powerful spell, it couldn't move mountains, but achieving the fine detail built into Maligree's complex syllables took a finely tuned skill.
"You will observe,"
Bilias added.
"Nothing up my sleeve."
His lips began to move. His hands flickered through the air. A pool of golden sparks sizzled in the palm of his hand, curved up, formed a faint sphere, began to fill in the detail. Legend had it that Maligri, one of the last of the true sorcerers, created the garden as a small, timeless, private, self-locking universe where he could have a quiet smoke and a bit of a think while avoiding the cares of the world. Which was itself a puzzle because no wizard could possibly understand how any being as powerful as a sorcerer could have a care in the world. Whatever the reason, Maligri retreated further and further into a world of his own and then one day closed the entrance after him. The garden was a glittering ball in Bilias's hand. The nearest wizards craned admiringly over his shoulders and looked down into a 2-foot sphere that showed a delicate, flower-strewn landscape. There was a lake in the middle distance, complete in every ripple, and purple mountains behind an interesting-looking forest. Tiny birds the size of bees flew from tree to tree, and a couple of deer no larger than mice glanced up from their grazing and stared out at Coin, who said critically,
"It's quite good. Give it to me."
He took the intangible globe out of the wizard's hands and held it up.
"Why isn't it bigger?" he said.
Bilias mopped his brow with a lace-edged handkerchief.
"Well," he said weakly, so stunned by Coin's tone that he was quite unable to be affronted, "since the old days the efficacity of the spell has rather..."
Coin stood with his head on one side for a moment as though listening to something. Then he whispered a few syllables and stroked the surface of the sphere. It expanded. One moment it was a toy in the boy's hands, and the next, the wizards were standing on cool grass in a shady meadow rolling down to the lake. There was a gentle breeze blowing from the mountains. It was scented with thyme and hay. The sky was deep blue, shading to purple at the zenith. The deer watched the newcomers suspiciously from their grazing ground under the trees. Spelter looked down in shock. A peacock was pecking at his bootlaces. He began and stopped. Coin was still holding a sphere of air. Inside it, distorted as though seen through a fisheye lens or the bottom of a bottle, was the great hall of the Unseen University. The boy looked around at the trees, squinted thoughtfully at the distant snow-capped mountains, and nodded at the astonished men.
"It's not bad," he said. "I should like to come here again."
He moved his hands in a complicated motion that seemed, in some unexplained way, to turn them inside out. Now the wizards were back in the hall, and the boy was holding the shrinking garden in his palm. In the heavy, shocked silence, he put it back into Bilias's hands and said,
"That was quite interesting. Now I will do some magic."
He raised his hands, stared at Bilias, and vanished him.
Pandemonium broke out, as it tends to on these occasions. In the centre of it stood Coin, totally composed, in a spreading cloud of greasy smoke. Ignoring the tumult, Spelter bent down slowly, and with extreme care picked a peacock feather off the floor. He rubbed it thoughtfully back and forth across his lips, as he looked from the doorway to the boy to the vacant Arch-Chancellor's chair, and his thin mouth narrowed, and he began to smile. An hour later, as thunder began to roll in the clear skies above the city, and Rincewind was beginning to sing gently and forget all about cockroaches, and a lone mattress was wandering the streets, Spelter shut the door of the Arch-Chancellor's study and turned to face his fellow mages. There were 6 of them, and they were very worried. They were so worried, Spelter noted, that they were listening to him, a mere 5th-level wizard.
"He's gone to bed," he said, "with a hot milk drink."
"Milk?"
said one of the wizards, with tired horror in his voice.
"He's too young for alcohol," explained the bursar.
"Oh, yes, silly of me."
The hollow-eyed wizard opposite said,
"Did you see what he did to the door?"
"I know what he did to Bilias."
"What did he do?"
"I don't want to know."
"Brothers, brothers," said Spelter soothingly. He looked down at their worried faces and thought, "Too many dinners. Too many afternoons waiting for the servants to bring in the tea. Too much time spent in stuffy rooms reading old books written by dead men. Too much gold brocade and ridiculous ceremony. Too much fat. The whole university is ripe for one good push. Or one good pull."
"I wonder if we really have a problem here," he said.
Gravy Derment of the Sages of the Unknown Shadow hit the table with his fist.
"Good grief, man!" he snapped. "Some child wanders in out of the night, beats two of the university's finest, sits down in the Arch-Chancellor's chair, and you wonder if we have a problem? The boy's a natural! From what we've seen tonight, there isn't a wizard on the disk who could stand against him!"
"Why should we stand against him?" said Spelter, in a reasonable tone of voice.
"Because he's more powerful than we are!"
"Yes?" Spelter's voice would have made a sheet of glass look like a ploughed field. It made honey look like gravel.
"It stands to reason!"
Gravy hesitated. Spelter gave him an encouraging smile.
"Ahem."
The Ahummer was Marmaric Carding, head of the Hoodwinkers. He steepled his beringed fingers and peered sharply at Spelter over the top of them. The bursar disliked him intensely. He had considerable doubt about the man's intelligence. He suspected it might be quite high, and that behind those vein-crazed jowls was a mind full of brightly polished little wheels, spinning like mad.
"He does not seem overly inclined to use that power," said Carding.
"What about Bilias and Virid?"
"Childish pique," said Carding.
The other wizards stared from him to the bursar. They were aware of something going on and couldn't quite put their finger on it. The reason that wizards didn't rule the disk was quite simple. Hand any two wizards a piece of rope and they would instinctively pull in opposite directions. Something about their genetics or their training left them with an attitude towards mutual cooperation that made an old bull elephant with terminal toothache look like a worker ant. Spelter spread his hands.
"Brothers," he said again, "do you not see what has happened? Here is a gifted youth, perhaps raised in isolation out in the untutored countryside, who, feeling the ancient call of the magic in his bones, has journeyed far across tortuous terrain, through who knows what perils, and at last has reached his journey's end, alone and afraid, seeking only the steadying influence of us, his tutors, to shape and guide his talents. Who are we to turn him away into the wintry blast, shunning his—"
The oration was interrupted by Gravy blowing his nose. "It's not winter," said one of the other wizards flatly, "and it's quite a warm night."
"Out into the treacherously changeable spring weather," snarled Spelter, "and cursed indeed would be the man who failed at this time."
"It's nearly summer."
Carding rubbed the side of his nose thoughtfully.
"The boy has a staff," he said. "Who gave it to him, did you ask?"
"No," said Spelter, still glowering at the almanacical interjector. Carding started to look at his fingernails in what Spelter considered to be a meaningful way.
"Well, whatever the problem, I feel sure it can wait until morning,"
he said in what Spelter felt was an ostentatiously bored voice.
"Ye gods, he blew Bilias away," said Gravy, "and they say there's nothing in Virid's room but soot."
"They were perhaps rather foolish," said Carding smoothly. "I'm sure, my good brother, that you would not be defeated in affairs of the art by a mere stripling."
Gravy hesitated.
"Well, he said, "no, of course not."
He looked at Carding's innocent smile and coughed loudly.
"Certainly not, of course. Bilias was very foolish. However, some prudent caution is surely—"
"Then let us all be cautious in the morning," said Carding cheerfully. "Brothers, let us adjourn this meeting. The boy sleeps, and in that at least he is showing us the way. This will look better in the light."
"I have seen things that didn't," said Gravy darkly, who didn't trust youth. He held that no good ever came of it.
The senior wizards filed out and back to the great hall, where the dinner had got to the ninth course and was just getting into its stride. It takes more than a bit of magic and someone being blown to smoke in front of him to put a wizard off his food. For some unexplained reason, Spelter and Carding were the last to leave. They sat at either end of the long table, watching each other like cats. Cats can sit at either end of a lane and watch each other for hours, performing the kind of mental manoeuvring that would make a Grand Master appear impulsive by comparison. But cats have got nothing on wizards. Neither was prepared to make a move until he had run the entire forthcoming conversation through his mind to see if it left him a move ahead. Spelter weakened first. "All wizards are brothers," he said. "We should trust one another. I have information."
"I know," said Carding. "You know who the boy is."
Spelter's lips moved soundlessly as he tried to foresee the next bit of the exchange.
"You can't be certain of that," he said after a while.
"My dear Spelter, you blush when you inadvertently tell the truth."
"I didn't blush."
"Precisely," said Carding. "My point."
"All right," Spelter conceded. "But you think you know something else?"
The fat wizard shrugged. "A mere suspicion of a hunch," he said. "But why should I—" "A lie."
He rolled the unfamiliar word around his tongue.
"With you, a mere fifth level, I could more certainly obtain the information by rendering down your living brain. I mean no offence, you understand. I ask only for knowledge."
The events of the next few seconds happened far too fast to be understood by non-wizards, but went approximately like this. Spelter had been drawing the signs of Megrim's accelerator in the air under cover of the table. Now he muttered a syllable under his breath and fired the spell along the tabletop, where it left a smoking path in the varnish and met about halfway the silver snakes of Brother Hushmaster's potent asp spray as they spewed from Carding's fingertips. The two spells cannoned into one another, turned into a ball of green fire, and exploded, filling the room with fine yellow crystals. The wizards exchanged the kind of long, slow glare you could roast chestnuts on. Bluntly, Carding was surprised. He shouldn't have been. Eighth-level wizards are seldom faced with challenging tests of magical skill. In theory, there are only seven other wizards of equal power, and every lesser wizard is by definition, well, lesser. This makes them complacent. But Spelter, on the other hand, was at the fifth level. It may be quite tough at the top, and it is probably even tougher at the bottom, but halfway up it's so tough you could use it for horseshoes. By then all the no-hopers, the lazy, the silly, and the downright unlucky have been weeded out. The field's cleared, and every wizard stands alone and surrounded by mortal enemies on every side. There's the pushy fours below, waiting to trip him up. There's the arrogant sixes above, anxious to stamp out all ambition. And, of course, all around are his fellow fives, ready for any opportunity to reduce the competition a little. And there's no standing still. Wizards of the fifth level are mean and tough, and have reflexes of steel, and their eyes are thin and narrow from staring down the length of that metaphorical last furlong, at the end of which rests the prize of prizes, the Arch-Chancellor's hat.